You mentioned that you didn't think that you deserved better or different. Why is that?
I did a lot of bad things in my life, like a lot of really, really bad things. Grade 7, I'd been arrested for my first time, had first police cases against me. I was an alcoholic by grade 8, drug addict by grade 9. Like, I used to take pride in it. Like, I actually had a t-shirt that said, "I am all the things your parents warned you about." So they knew that I wasn't on the right track, but I don't think they had any idea as to how far off the track I was.
Why would you choose to go rather than to change your life?
And your whole life is just built around feeding your addiction. Because, like, for instance, we had by the N1 bridge, there was this homeless group of people that slept there. Those were my friends. But I'd sort of made peace with, like, this is my life and I'm just doing this till I die. And then, like, if I early again, just leave me. Like, I'm done. And he got me going again. I was like, but this was God's plan for my life. So I am an example to other people of what not to be.
It's actually the moments where love was expressed to you that changed you the most.
Yeah.
It's what you've encountered in terms of community and friendships in your rehabilitation. And I think that's such a beautiful narrative. The person in front of me is living a very different life to the Garo of 5, 10, 15, and 20 years ago. And from what I've come to learn, that's a very interesting story of very high highs and very low lows. But invite us into where it all started for you, how you grew up, your family structure, and those kind of things.
Yeah, so I'm Garo, originally from Paro, so it makes people easy to remember. I think I grew up in a pretty good household, as normal people do. Mom and Dad are still married today. Got a brother and a sister. And I just was an unhappy child, for lack of a better term. And so to make just long stories very short, I ended up going a bit off the tracks in primary school from standard 2. I still remember the moments that happened, grade 4 for the younger listeners. And then, by end of grade 7, I'd been arrested for my first time, had first police cases against me. I was an alcoholic by grade 8, drug addict by grade 9. And then, life just got sort of better, worse from there. It took me down a road of about 20 plus, just over 20 years of addiction and everything that comes with it. Ended up, I had a previous wife, life, and a child that I lost due to those things. Also, obviously, lost all ties with my family and everything else, because it's not nice being family and friends with a criminal. I actually ended up being homeless, sleeping here on the streets of Belleville for about 8 years. And then in 2013, met someone that God sent across my path, went to a restoration center, got my life sort of sorted out. And from there, I've had an interesting journey with God till where I am today, which is married with 3 little kids of my own.
Sure. I want to go back to the moment where you said that you were an unhappy child. Why were you unhappy?
So I just want to frame this with, everybody does the best they can with the knowledge that they've got. So looking back today, I don't blame anyone for anything, but I'm the youngest of 3 children, and my brother and my sister, so I've got a sister that's got Down syndrome. She's an amazing little lady. And then I've got an older brother as well, but they were both of them obviously demanded a lot of attention, and I was sort of the model child up until grade 4. Because I was straight A student, top of my class, So parents tend to leave the child that's doing well and focus more on trying to get the other children doing well, because obviously 30, 40 years ago, we didn't have the same or as widespread psychological knowledge as we did now. So there was a lot of things I didn't understand as a child, which I now understand as a parent. So for instance, I'd always get my brother's old clothes. And from a parent financial point of view, it's like, well, kids grow fast. There's nothing wrong with those clothes. so you can just use them because it saves money. From a child's perspective, it's like, why can brother and sister get new things and I can't? Like, am I not worthy of the same love? Like, sort of that's how a child's brain equates it. So today I get it because I do the same thing with my kids. So there was just because they needed a lot of attention and I sort of didn't need as much attention because I was doing well. I think I went into a performance thing, and no one's ever happy if you're in a performance mode the whole time. You can't be happy with life because you're never actually living and finding out who you are and doing what you want to do that brings joy to your soul or fulfillment to you. You're doing what you think your parents want you to do or these people want you to do or that. So that breeds unhappiness at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And at that moment in grade four, when you started to make the wrong decisions, what was going through your mind? Were you looking for an escape? Were you looking for something to bring more attention to you? Or what was the reason?
I wish I had something deeper than this to say. I wanted to be cool. like I was the typical nerd. Like I was hair in a side path, glasses.
So you mean like I am today?
Just worse. Like the proper old school side path glasses. Always asked to play games last, etc., etc. I hope you don't mind me using your name, but I sat next to Stephen Grobler, and man, that boy could swear in grade four. And he taught me to swear, and then swearing makes you cool amongst kids back then. Now you've got to do substantially more. But back then, and then it's just like, so, I did it more for acceptance than anything else, just because I wanted to be part of a group, if I could call it that, and not be the last person chosen for everything. Even though my athletic abilities are fine, and.
Mm-hmm. And during those, what did you start off with? Smoking, drinking, drugs?
So, standard two, swearing and smoking. It's cute when you do it in standard two, but when you get to grade seven and you're smoking a pack a day, it's not that cute anymore. So it started off with swearing, then smoking, obviously a bit of an aggressive thing going with all of that. And then when I hit high school, obviously that your frame of reference changes quite a lot, because then we're like the big kids in primary school are smoking, like the big kids in high school are using drugs. So it immediately, and I went into high school as a cool kid. So by the end of standard six, I was grade eight, I was a full-fledged alcoholic to the point of where we had a little 7-Eleven like a block away from our house, and I always went there for my dad to buy his cigarettes and, which made life so much easier when I needed to buy myself cigarettes, because I could just go as a 12-year-old and be like, these are for my dad. And then I started telling them I'm buying wine for my dad. So the 7-Elevens used to sell crackling. It's like cheap man champagne, bubbly wine. And I would, in grade nine, I would, every day after school, I would be buying two or three bottles of that during the course of the evening while I'm doing my homework, like to get me through till the next day. And so that was then at six, then at seven, started doing drugs and other things. And then by standard eight, grade 10, I was an addict to the point where we had drug dealers are actually great entrepreneurs. So we had like a Mr. Delivery for drugs. We had a few of them. So we would literally phone just before break, the period before break, we'd make a call from school and have the dealers come through and meet us at the school gates during break time so that we could use to get through the day, because otherwise you'd get sick and.
Did your parents know about what you are doing? And that the teachers and people at school recognize that there's a change in what?
So my parents knew, because obviously with, you know, grade seven being like getting a letter and having the police contact them, and it's like, you know, your son's robbed someone, and that's when I found out the nice word for mugging someone is accosting, because I was looking, look, you accosted someone. That's so, and I was like, that means you robbed them. It's like, you know, so, I mean, they knew obviously that I was no longer the model child, but I don't think that they knew, had any idea of the extent that, because like, for instance, we had by the N1 bridge, there was this homeless group of people that slept there. those were my friends from grade eight. Like I would, at night when I'm home and I can't get to my real friends, like I'd go sit with them and got these 5 liter pupsack wine things in the silver. Like we'd go sit and drink wine and smoke ganja in the bush, and then, you know, sometimes I'd even tell them I'm sleeping over and sleep over there. So they knew that I wasn't on the right track, but I don't think they had any idea as to how far off the track I was.
Mm-hmm. Take us to that moment where you went from being part of your family to you're now homeless.
I think it's a, I don't think there's one moment. I think it's one of those things that happen sort of over time, because I moved out for the first, like right as soon as I finished school, I moved out for the first time. I think I may have even moved out for like a month while I was still in school. Standard seven, like if I didn't have to be home, I wasn't home. So I wasn't part of my family since high school already. I wasn't like, you know, December holidays, I'd come home twice maybe. I didn't even come home on Christmas. So I'd removed myself from the family long before it got to a point of where I was actually told, like, don't actually come back again, you know. And that was a long journey, and my parents did, I think, like any parents, they showed a lot of grace, they had a lot of mercy. There was a lot of like times where they forgave me where they shouldn't. There was a lot of times where they took me back and tried to help me and did the best. But after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, it sort of gets to a point where you're like, hey, you're destroying everyone here, and we sort of need to start looking after us above you, because you're not trying from your side.
Mm. Is it something that you believe your parents could have done differently to instill from a young age to not go that route?
I don't think about it too much, because to me it's like that those are counterfactual arguments. So as much as I could look back and be like, oh, they should have done this, they should have hugged me more, they should have, I'm not saying they should have hugged me more, but I'm just saying, you know, as much as I can look back now and say they should have done this or they should have done that, I think I would have just grown up with a different set of problems. Because I think we all go through stuff in life and face trials and things that we are unhappy with, and at the end of the day, it's how we respond to it. So, you know, as much as I could go back and be like, hey, they should have bought me new clothes, because it would have made me feel more loved and I would have been a whole person. It's like if they were buying me new clothes, I might have been like, you guys aren't giving me enough attention. Now, you know, and if they'd given me clothes and attention, I might have been like, hey, my friends' parents are taking them on overseas holidays every year and you aren't taking us, you don't love. So that's why I said, like, I don't think I would change anything if they go back, because I think I would have still probably walked the same road. I would have just had different excuses for getting there or different reasons for getting there.
And as 41-year-old Garrow, if we take the responsibility away from your parents, what would you say to yourself at that point in grade four, just before everything went sideways?
It's one of those funny things where, like, they've got this thing where they say, like, ask a teenager while they still know everything. And it's like, I think sort of, especially because of even how culture was then, but how culture is now as well, you tend to glorify the wrong things and see, you know, where culture will tell you the man is the one that can drink the most and fight the hardest. That's like, no, in reality, the man is the one that's providing to the best of his ability for his family and that's home spending time with him. But like, as a child, if you're looking at it and you're like, you know, you see two men on TV and the one is sitting home taking care of his baby and the other one is on horseback with a shotgun busy shooting at, like, you're like, hey man, I want to be like that dude on horseback. You don't think like, I want to be like that. So I don't know if there is anything I could have said to myself, especially because of my mindset as well, because like I used to take pride in it. Like, I actually had a t-shirt that said, I am all the things your parents warned you about. Like, you know, so it's like, I don't think it would have mattered what, I don't think there's anything I could have said to myself that would have changed the outcome. Maybe, but then it would also have changed the rest of the course of my life. And I don't know, with what I've got today, I don't know if I would sacrifice that for less suffering previously. If that makes sense.
Take us to the first time that you had to beg and that you had to steal, and that where you were pushed to the point where almost a rock bottom moment of, okay, this is now my life, this is what I need to do to survive. What went through your mind?
So that actually came quite late in the story, because you can still be working and be homeless. You can still be... So I was a criminal, working criminal, whatever, while I was homeless for quite a few years. And then the one time, I think it was about 2010, when my then wife, my previous wife and I both got arrested and she was pregnant. And we ended up going to jail, two separate jails. And obviously you don't want your baby born in jail and, but the way things just played out is we both got released and we got to come out on sort of parole or whatever, on bail, sorry, not on parole. And I just remember that that moment I was like, but I want to change my life because this is like, I'm going to have a child and I don't want the child to be born in jail and I don't want all of these things. So I sort of made a deal with God and I was like, okay, I'm going to do the best that I can in the situation that I'm in, and then I'm like hoping that you're going to sort me out further. So what that meant was that I wouldn't break into houses anymore, I wouldn't rob people anymore, I would stop like all the illegal activity. And sort of like say the way I processed it in my mind is like, if you're breaking into someone's house or robbing them, you're giving them trauma and no choice. Where if I'm just coming up to you in a parking lot or at a robot asking you, it's sort of your choice whether you give to me or not. So that was the moment that, well, that was the thing that got me to go to actually begging instead of doing other things for money.
What goes through your mind? There's obviously two perspectives. The guy that's sitting in his lovely car, driving up to the robot, and then the person standing there. What goes through your mind as these cars pass you by 7 o'clock in the morning? What do you think about?
So you don't think about much. As much as you do deeply, you try not to think about much because it'll really drive you crazy. The guy driving past isn't that bad. It's when like a hot woman stops in a car, then you're like, oh, shucks, you know? But not that much goes through your mind. But then again, also with the kind of thinking I had at that time, so like my cousin never went the drug route because of my drugs. Like my brother never became. So like I had this thing where I was like, but this was God's plan for my life. So I am an example of other people, to other people, of what not to be. So I didn't feel like I deserved better. I didn't feel like I shouldn't be here or... You know, and if you're a beggar on the street thing, because there is people that are working, there is people that are like, you're sort of the lowest on the pecking order, if I can call it. So even other homeless people look down on beggars. It's a very weird dynamic. But I'd sort of made peace with like, this is my life and I'm just doing this till I die. And then like, what'll be will be.
And you mentioned that you didn't think that you deserved better or different. Why is that?
I did a lot of bad things in my life, like a lot of really, really bad things. If you don't have a good understanding of how the world works and of how grace works and you're very hooked up to a legalistic and a judgment thing, it's like because of what I did, I didn't think that I deserved better. Up until a few years ago, that was still my thinking. Like when I would struggle and stuff, I'm like, but I'm also the kind of person where like I'm happy doing it, because it's like there's this saying where they say don't cry over the results you didn't get from the work you didn't do. But that works the other way as well. Don't cry over the consequences you get from the stuff you did do. So I knew that me being there, it's not like it was a sob story of like, I grew up as an orphan and at 18 there was nowhere for me to go and then life was just hard and I ended up here and I felt wronged. It was like, no, I've ended up here because I've got 20 years of doing everything that a person shouldn't do. So it didn't really... It wasn't a sad thing for me that I was there. It was just like, well, this is the consequence of my life.
I find it interesting because often when you see a beggar or you drive past a beggar, there's always this question of how did you get here? The typical question of how did you get to the point where you basically lose everything and all reasons for hope, basically. And then my second question usually is like, was there nowhere to go? And I think my question to you is then, even though you didn't necessarily think yourself out of that space, was there no one that you could reach to, family or friend, or somebody that is not off of the streets that you perhaps could like reach out to kind of get you on the right path or just give you some perspective?
So pre-plague, I had never met when I was actually still living on the street. So after COVID, obviously some people had their whole support networks fall away, etc. And I haven't really been doing stuff on the street, so I don't know what the demographic is now. But before COVID, so up to 2010, 2013, in the 8 years that I was on the street, I didn't meet one person there that was there out of circumstance and not personal choice. So I didn't meet one person that was there because if you are a normal, decent person, you cannot tell me that there's not one person that's willing to let you sleep on their couch instead of sleeping in a bush. So the people that are on the street are sort of all the people. So my parents took me in numerous times, coming out of jail, coming out of rehabs. Like they gave me more chances than any person deserves. I've got an auntie that loves me more than people should love people either. She also took me into her house. I stole from her. I did. So eventually, you know, where if it normal people would think like, okay, I've got 6 months that it's going to be bad. When that 6 months turns into 8 years of you burning every bridge that you've got, then you sort of end up at a point where people are like, but I can't take you back into my house because you steal from me when you're here. Like, I can't take you back into my house because you're so high that there's airplanes coming past under you while you're here. Like, I can't. So it's not that I didn't have anyone. It's that for the kind of person I was, there wasn't anybody that it was safe for them to have me in their space, which is why now, like, I've got a whole support network now. Like, if anything had to happen now, I like to think that there's a lot of couches my family and I can go sleep on. But it's not needed. It's just so I don't bear anybody any ill will. And then, yes, there's lots of places you can go. But the problem is when you go those places, part of the thing that comes with it is you can't do drugs. And it's like, well, then that's not worth it. So if you look, night shelters in Cape Town, like Cape Town Bellville or Elam Shelter down here, like R8 a night. And for that, you get a meal in the evening, coffee in the evening, breakfast in the morning, a shower and somewhere to keep your stuff. I mean, R8, bed and breakfast, that's amazing. But you've got to be in there by 6 o'clock the night, I think it is, and you've got to be out by 7 o'clock the morning, and you're not allowed to do any drugs while you're there. So like, hey man, 6 o'clock is still drugging time. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock is still time for making money because I need a shot in the morning when I wake up. So it's not that I can't go to a night shelter or it's that I choose not to because it takes away from what I need to do to cope with my addiction. And that was, like I say, pre-COVID, that was every single person I'd ever met on the street.
Sure. What were some of your highest highs and your lowest lows during those 8 years on the street?
The highs are quite, I think the highs are stuff that normal people take for granted. So bear in mind when I was on the street initially, the first few years I was still working or doing criminal things. So like you'd hit a house and get a lot of money and you'd be able to book yourself into a nice hotel for 2 weeks and just lie there playing games and doing drugs 24 hours a day. It's amazing. Or, you know, like we'd hire ourselves like those Cape Town taxis, not the minibus ones, but the other ones, and we'd literally just have them drive us up and down and we'd sit smoking crack in the back or like, you know, things like that are fun then, but like those are your highs. They're not the kind of highs you actually want from life. And then the lows, I think, is like anything else. Well, not like anybody else's, but it's when you end up in jail and you're like, flip, this is, because jail's not how it's portrayed in movies, but it's also not a very nice place, because the difference between South African jails and overseas jails is overseas, if you're a guy that stole from a shop and you go to jail, you're sort of amongst other people that stole from shops. In South Africa, if you stole from a shop and you go to jail, you're with murderers and rapists. And especially for me being a white person, which is the lowest demographic in jail, it's like you walk into a cell built for 24 people that's sleeping 41 and you're the only white person in there. It's a bit like not the ideal place to be. So I think jail was some of the lows. And then you also get very sick from withdrawals, which makes you very despondent and. So when you, like the rains we've just had in Cape Town, like when it's pouring with rain and you sleeping wet in a bush going through withdrawals with nothing in your pocket and you haven't eaten for 2 days, then you sort of like, well, shoo, man, life sucks a bit at the moment.
Sure. Before we transition to the redemption part of the story, obviously you mentioned that you burnt bridges along the way and there were some people that you might have hurt and stuff like that. What would you tell those people now?
Look, I think I've spoken to all those people now. Obviously, people that I've hurt that ran into me as a consequence of my life, it's not really people that were invested in my life. There's not really much I can say other than I'm sorry for the person you met back then, and thankfully I'm not that person anymore. But to the people that are active parts of my life, like my family, my brother, my aunt, my cousin, like sort of they all, because they walked the road and saw the downhill and have seen everything else, like there's been forgiveness and there's been like I've literally gone to them and apologized for my life. And most of them have told me that's not necessary because they just wanted me out. It's not that they were writing me off because they didn't want better for me. It was just paining them too much to see what I was going through the whole time. And I think it's a difficult thing when you see someone suffering and on their way to killing themselves. And there's like, because we were literally at the point I fought with a friend of mine, because we have this thing where if you OD, like you'll be amazed, the heroin addicts on the street, all of them know CPR. That's amazing, because when your friend ODs, like you've literally got to get his heart going again. And I still remember that I hit a friend of mine because I ODed, and we'd spoken about this lots, and I was like, if I OD again, just leave me, like I'm done. And he got me going again, and I actually hit him, and I was like, dude, it was over. Why couldn't you just let me go? And now, 10 years later, having a wife and 3 kids, like I get it. So I'd probably apologize to him for hitting him and be like, thanks, dude. But once again, I don't think there's anything you can say. I think words are a very superficial thing. So I don't think there's anything you can really say to make up for the stuff you've done. There's a small percentage of people that like need that apology. But I think for most people, it's the way you live your life forward that sort of makes what they had to go through worthwhile and forgivable, if I can put it that way.
Mm-hmm. At that point where you OD'd and you wanted to go, why would you choose to go rather than to change your life?
Because your thinking isn't very good. And your whole life is just built around feeding your addiction. So with most drugs, stopping is easy. Well, not easy, but it's like it's manageable. Heroin's a very different kind of drug, which is why it's got the stigma that's attached to it is attached to it. It's got a very good reason. And the drive that it gives you is also very different. Like the drive to not get sick, because the sickness is saying, like the sickness, the withdrawals is literally bad enough that it can kill you under the wrong circumstances. And to give you an example of how bad the withdrawal is, so, you know, if you're sleeping on the street, things aren't very hygienic. you share needles, and I had a buddy that shared needles with someone who used a dirty needle, and he got infection in his blood. And the next thing, his one finger started like rotting off because it got septicemia in from this blood disease. This dude, rather than going to sit at a clinic, walked around like that because it was better to walk around with the pain of having an actual limb rot off than to go sit at a clinic where you have to withdraw. Like, and at the end of the day, his finger rotted off about halfway, and then the bone broke and it closed. It was actually quite amazing. And he used to carry the piece of bone around and be like, hey, let me tell you this, man. You know? So it's just like, and people that haven't gone through it, and I pray to God that most people never have to, or that all people never have to, like, you won't understand what that drive is until you get there. It's worse than being hungry or thirsty, or it's like that is the only drive you've got. So you don't even think about getting out, because it's like, I remember I'd sit in Sea Point by the beach using, and just the way your thinking also changes. Like, I'd see people playing putt-putt with their family, and I'd be like, sure, man, how sad is your life? Like, that's what you need to come do. Like, you need to come hit a ball with a stick. Like, sure, dude, live a little, you know? And it was just like the thought of having to live life sober and do things like that was almost more depressing than being on the street. Today that I'm, like, soberly thinking, like, I go play putt-putt with my kids. It's amazing. I run around in the yard looking like a chop with my kids. It's amazing. Where beforehand I'd walk past people like that. And so there wasn't really any drive, because I didn't see the value in living like that, because I knew that if I stopped, it meant also no any other drugs and no drinking and I was like, but what a boring, morbid life would that be? Like, why would I want to go through all the suffering for that? Why would I want, you know, it's that those lies you thought, like, why would I want to get a job, have to work, pay bills, do, like, at the moment, it sucks not being able to eat the whole time, or, you know, but, like, we had this joke always, we were like, what's the best thing about having a homeless girlfriend? Like, you can drop her off anywhere after your date. It's just like, you know, it's just like, why do I want to pay bills and have to do all these things if I can go sleep when I want, get up when I want, use what I want, and there's no accountability to it? Like, why would I want to make myself part of the machine? And, like, now that my brain's cleared, like, I get it. But back then, having a sober life and a place to pay bills wasn't enough of a reason. And because I'd been written off by everyone already and didn't see those relationships ever being restored, I didn't really have a reason to.
Where did everything start to change for you?
So that time when I got out of jail and I said, God, I'm going to be good as I can, which means still using drugs but not partaking in other criminal activities. And then that carried on for about 3 years. And then one day God sent someone. I was hiking, and God had a guy pick me up, and we got into conversation, and he invited me for a meal. And at the end of the meal, he asked me, what do I want? Do I want money or do I want help? And I said, I want help. And he ended up doing like a crowdfunding thing on Facebook, sent me to a restoration center. Then life just started from there.
Why was this different? Were you quite deep in your faith even through those times on the street? And leading up to that point, and why was this point of departure or this change in the journey strong enough for you to kind of start leaving the bad stuff behind?
So I think previous times, because I've been through quite a few rehabs and stuff. So I think previous times my motivations were wrong, if I can call it that. And I remember I went to this rehab once, and this guy said something to me, as long as you've still got bridges you think you can burn, you shouldn't be here. And it was on like my third day in rehab, and I was like, yeah, I'm not done. And I just walked out again. And I think I just reached the low point of my life where I realized, like, oh, I'm done. And I really want to Yeah, I think I just got to that point where, like, I'm done. Like, I'd wanted to stop using for 8 years, then going to jail and losing my first child sort of just got me to that last point of, like, I'm over it. And then also the place I went to, Hope Farm in Hopefield, they are a restoration center, not a rehabilitation center. So it's where other places you sort of, you go, you locked in, you signed in. It's like you're there for a program and you're just there for 5 weeks or for 2 months or Hope Farm, like the gates are open. You want to leave, you leave. It's like if you want to be here, you're here because you want to be here. We don't keep you here. We don't have the police bring you back. Like if you want to walk out, you walk out. So I think being in that environment where I had to make the decision that I want to be here as opposed to I'm here because someone's forcing me to be here, I think it makes the amount of work and the way you put in the work very different. So it's like for a normal person with their job, if you have to do something and you're doing it because someone told you to and you have to finish X, you'll do it in a certain way. But to another person that's doing that exact same thing, but they're doing it because it brings them joy and it's something that they want to do, the results will just be so much better. So I think because my motives had changed and I was actually there because I wanted to be there and I'd asked for it, I'd waited 3 years for it, like I took it a lot more seriously and I actually put in the work with God, because their thing is also they're a restoration center, so they don't focus on the addiction, they focus on the spirit, and they're like their whole thing is like seek God first and the rest will be added. So they work on fixing what's wrong with your spirit, what's lacking in your spirit, and then they trust that to flow over into the other parts of your life.
Let's talk about those perspective changes that you had to make, because obviously there's the physical aspect of taking you out of your environment to help you come clean. But what are some of the mindsets that you had to shift in terms of the way that you view, like the situation with the putt-putt that you explained, like the way that you viewed happiness, joy, success, and what life actually should look like?
So I think that that's a long process. There's still like some stuff that I'm processing today, and it's been a decade. I think that those are small things that change along the way, but it's by how you decide to look at life. So to give you a stupid example, when I was there, I didn't know how to be happy because I hadn't just been happy, like been in a position where I was not using drugs or when I was just normally happy. Like I didn't know how to cope with the emotion. And so whenever things happened that would make a normal person happy, like I'd actually lose it and get aggressive and start getting into fights with people. And there was this guy there, this nice guy that's like a foot taller than me and quite a beast. And the one day when I also was supposed to be happy and I started losing it, like he actually grabbed me and he just hugged me and he was like, "Garrett, it's all right, bro. You can just be happy." And it sort of took me back and I was like, yeah, I'm not. So like that was like a that of like learning to how to actually deal with emotions, because people say drugs help you escape from reality. They don't, but they're brilliant at numbing the reality of reality and everything that comes with it. So I think it's been a process of where like almost I've been a child and I've had to relearn how to do everything. So, you know, I had to learn how to be happy and how to just, I still need to learn how to be able to take a compliment. I needed to learn like with my body, as much of an overshare as this might be, but I needed to learn, like, do I need to go to the toilet now or am I having withdrawals? Because I didn't know what, like, because heroin is a numbing thing. Like, I didn't even know what I was feeling or how I was feeling it. So I think it was a total reset in a lot of things, and it was just by me being like, I'm trying. I want to be better. I want to do things differently. And obviously I knew that everything that I'd done for the last 20 years was not the way to do it. So I was very open to correction. And then I was very good with my quiet time, my daily quiet time. And there's actually a lot of things that happen and stuff that gets imparted in your quiet time where, like, you'll go through things and it'll be like, no, actually, you just need to learn some humility here. Or you need to just, or you'll read something that just makes something that you're going through drop differently and you'll change your perspective on it.
You mentioned that there are still some things that you're dealing with now. What are those things?
So some of it is internal. So I think we're all growing, always. But for instance, I'm not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. So I think, like a lot of people in the country, we're going through some financial challenges and then you'll have that almost like a loathing where you're saying to yourself, but if you had done better in life, you'd been able to provide better for your family now. So their suffering now is actually a result of your enjoyment previously. So it's just working through stuff like that and realizing that that's not how God works and that we need to go through stuff. And when you're by yourself, it's easy to suffer. Like, suffering by yourself is nothing. Like, you can get stabbed and go sleep. It's like, it's because it's you. But when you've got other people that are dependent on you and you see them going through hardships, then it makes life a little bit harder and it makes you question things a bit more. So the things that I'm going through now is more just on the understandings of grace, the understandings of this, and then still some character traits, which once again I think is things that we all go through that I'm trying to just better myself, if I can call it that. So for instance, I'm a person that I'm a very shy, lovable, likes little animals, but I can be quite aggressive. So I'm always very aware of how I conduct myself and try and be very aware of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So one of the things I noticed is I don't have time for minibus taxis along the road. And some of the things I do is not right, but sort of I justify it by being like, well, in this specific situation, they're putting other people's lives at danger and I'm stopping them from doing that. So like I can justify that. But then on other things, like I'd notice when I'm driving on the N1, if a car puts on its flicker light, like I'll back up a bit and flash my lights and be like, there you go, dude. But then if I'm driving exact same situation and it's a taxi that puts on his flicker light, I'll speed up and go sit right behind the other car and like, you're not getting in here. And I'm like, but that's not right, because you're treating, you know, you don't know who's driving that taxi. You don't know. So with things like that, just my situationally, how I handle things and my preconceived notions of people and I'm trying to just work on so that you love everybody the same without judging them beforehand. Mm.
I think that is a continuous journey for all of us, no matter what your past looks like or what you've been through. I think we all have a journey towards spiritual transformation, which is in some cases a little bit more strenuous and a lot tougher for some people. But what is your kind of regime or regiment for this personal development, spiritual formation? Do you read a lot? Do you listen to podcasts? Or how do you stay grounded in your formation into a different or a better person?
So I think you need a lot of things, because there's a lot of different areas to your life. So I'm lucky, I've got a very far drive. Well, I've got like a 40-minute drive to work every day, because I work about 30-something Ks from where I stay. So I do the podcast thing a lot. I do the worship thing a lot. I try and start off every day, unless I oversleep, which maybe sometimes makes happen. I try and start every day by doing a bit of a Bible reading. And then more than that, I'm very open to correction and to listening to what other people have to say. So I think a problem that a lot of people have is they sort of seal themselves in this echo chamber where they've got a behavior and they'll just find, they'll ask 9 people if it's right, and the people will be like, no, it's not. And then the 10th person will say, yes, it's right, and they'll grab that 10th person and be like, this person agrees with me. where I'm sort of like good at weighing things up. So if I've got a position and I hear someone that's got the opposing position, I'll sort of sit and have a conversation with them or listen to what they've got to say and then try and weigh things up afterwards and be like, you know, what is actually the right thing to do? And I think between doing a whole lot of things, most people aren't open to correction. If you tell them like, hey, listen, yeah, what you're doing now is not actually, they'll get upset and offended and ask you not to come to their house again. Where I'll be like, okay, let me hear you out. And then let me speak to elders about it. So I'm also big on accountability and actually being linked in. I'm part of mentoring a church where we go, and just as men, we get to meet up and speak about manly things, you know, that you can't maybe speak about with your wife or in public and that helps you get perspective and helps you sort of people. If you've got honest people in your life that are calling you out on the things that you're doing wrong and you're actually taking that to heart and not getting offended by it, I think that helps a lot. So I'm very intentional about who I let into my life and about giving them the authority to speak into my life, if I can call it that way. Because my life is not, I'm not here to party. I'm not here to have a good time. Like, I'm here to try and know God, make him known, and add value to the people around me and the places that I go.
Why do you think we are so afraid to be corrected? And why is there this notion in society that we should all agree and accept everything that goes on around us and within us?
Sure, that's big questions. I think nobody wants to be wrong. I think social media and the culture is so about like, this is perfect, that's perfect, these people are amazing, that when you get called out on something being wrong, a lot of people's mindset is like, this is them. Instead of seeing this as, okay, it's an opportunity for me to grow and better myself, they see it as, this is an attack on who I am and my character. And it's like, no, it's not. It's all just your perspective on how you want to take it. So I think a lot of people see correction as a personal attack, and a lot of people, unfortunately, because of culture, actually see correction as a form of hate. So if we can get a bit controversial, like if you look at the whole movement around sexual identity and, you know, the whole thing has become that love is acceptance. If you love me, you'll accept me for who I am. And it's like, no, actually, if I love you, just like with my children, I need to correct you when you've got a wrong thinking. But people are so scared to stand up and actually say what the truth is, because they're scared of the hashtag cancel culture. And it's just like, no, man, you actually, if you claim to actually love people, you actually need to stand up and tell them the truth. And the whole thing about like, and my heart goes out to people that do really struggle with gender dysmorphia, and like, I think it's terrible, and like, my heart literally bleeds for you. But I don't think that the right way to get behind you and support you is by telling you, yes, you're right. Especially not when it's a cultural contagion at the moment, like the way it's going up. And I think too many people aren't willing to stand for the truth and stand in the gap. And that's why a lot of that happens. It's the same, like, men are being told to be weak. And it's like, no, men, like, if you go look what it takes to be a peaceful man, like, you can't claim to be a peaceful man if you're not capable of violence. Because if you're not capable of violence, you're a harmless man, not a peaceful man. And it's like, I ensure peace for my family, because if anything comes into my atmosphere, into my house, I've got the ability and willingness to be violent enough to protect them, to keep them safe, so that there's peace in my home. But the whole culture is changing to like, that's toxic masculinity and it's like, no, because if more men were willing to do that and actually stepped out, if your neighbor knew that if they get drunk and start being abusive, you're gonna go across and stop them and get the cops there, and they'd stop doing it. If everyone in the street knew that that's how the people in the street operate, like, if you want to fix society, start by fixing your home. Start by actually standing for truth, by helping people, by supporting people, by being willing to stand up and say the unpopular thing, no matter who it offends. And we try and say it in love and with grace, but it still needs to be said. And these days it's like, well, I don't want to come across as hateful. I want to come across as loving. Well, if you want to come across as loving, actually love people correctly. Actually, like, go and say, because I love you, I can't just agree with you. Because most of the arguments, if you take them to the extreme, it's like, where do you draw the line? Because now you've got someone saying, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body. I was born this way. You must accept me. And culture tells you, you must accept them. And it's like, okay, great. But now if the next guy comes along and says, I'm a 7-year-old trapped in a grown man's body, and I want to have relations with a 7-year-old girl because I was born that way. Surely not. But that's the next step. Like, so somewhere you need to draw the line, and the place to draw the line is just right back in the beginning. And if we actually start doing that and standing up for truth and loving people like we're called to, I think culture will start changing a lot, and you'll see that boy that's now looking at social media and getting his models and his heroes from there, when he sees his dad actually standing up and having a positive impact on the people around him, I think he might start wanting to model his dad rather than the guy sitting on the horse's back with a shotgun, you know?
Well, those are some powerful insights. As we land the plane, I would like to know, what is your perspective on joy and fulfillment now? Looking back, what would you say to somebody that's walking the same path that you are?
I think that, you know, depending how far down the path you are, I think that, the world at the moment at large chases happiness instead of chasing joy. And I think that joy is the thing you actually want to go after, because that's those valuable things, those fulfilling relationships you build with people around you, and those fulfilling things you do that add value to society, because that does make you feel good. It gives you a deep sense of it, almost like achievement, to know that you've done something to help people around you. Where at the moment, you know, the whole culture is about chasing happiness. It's about the next party, who can drink the most, who's having the best vacation. And then I think, like, because social media is so in our face the whole time, I think people are so, compare themselves so quickly to everyone on social media, and they, even if they know it, they don't get it, that it's actually just a highlight reel of people's lives. And what you're comparing yourself to is not really what that person's life is about. And then that comparison starts breeding contempt. And because you then sort of unhappy with where you are because your life doesn't look as perfect as theirs, you start chasing other things to give you those fleeting moments of happiness, instead of, like, put down your phone, get off Facebook. Like, instead of sitting scrolling for half an hour looking at the fake picture other people portrays, how about spending half an hour with your own family trying to build a better picture for them? So I think when people can unplug a bit and start getting there, and then to the people that, man, if you're still enjoying drugs, it sucks for you. I hope you get to a point where you don't enjoy it anymore. So that was I wasn't enjoying drugs anymore. It wasn't, like, drugs are very, very nice. That's why people get addicted. You know, people come around to schools and are like, drugs are bad. It's like, yeah, but they're so good, man. And that's the message we need to get. Like, that's why you need to be careful of using drugs, because they are so good and they make you feel so good and they make you feel popular and funny. And you think alcohol makes you funny and strong, you know? So if you're still enjoying drugs, like, I really, my prayer is that you get to a point where you're not enjoying it anymore, where, like, it's actually every day when you wake up, the fact that you need to go use something or is depressing. Like, to me, the nicest thing was when I just hit the restoration center after about 2 months, when I started sleeping, because for the first 2 months, because I had intense withdrawals, I didn't sleep. I couldn't stand for more than 2.5, 3 minutes at a time. Like, my body was just shattered. I was 6 foot, weighing 52 kilograms. It was bad. And I remember that after like 2 months when I realized like I can actually wake up in the morning and just get up. Like I don't have to start grabbing for a needle in the dark. I can actually, you know, go to a toilet like a normal person. I can go and make breakfast. I can, like, those small things gave me joy. And then I also think if that's for them. I hope they get to a point where they can sort of get to the end of enjoying drugs, because that's when you're going to stop. As long as you're enjoying it, like, you're never going to stop. You're just going to carry on and on and on. But then for, like, the greater part of people, what I find helps me a lot is, like, I'm very into my thankfulness and my gratitude. Like, I remember being in the restoration center and we all had duties. And, like, some of those duties are, like, you got to clean the floors or you got to wash dishes. And then people will moan and they'll be like, oh, we got to wash dishes for 20 people. I'm like, sure, dude, give it to me. I haven't had dishes to wash for 8 years. Like, I haven't had a floor to mop for 10 years. Give it to me. Like, I'll do. Like, I was thankful that I had a dish to wash or a floor to mop. And even now, I'm thankful for the things I have. So I think if we, like, if you want to flip comparison on its head, instead of the way we normally do now, looking at the Insta influencers and that's got 20 million followers and just posts everything, you know, they're buying mansions for their parents, and like, compare yourself down, because there's always people worse off than you. And when you start comparing yourself down, it helps you be thankful for what you've got. You know, like, I've got sick kids, 2 of my 3 have chronic illnesses. And it's like, as much as that could get me down and I can be like, oh, look how other people get to run in the park with their kids, then I like look at other people that's kids are in wheelchairs or that have just, and I'm like, oh, thank you God for my kids. Like, I'm happy to bear that cross. You know, if you want to, you know, you're upset about your 10-year-old car that you're driving, like, look at the oak that's standing waiting for a taxi in the rain. You know, you want to be upset about flipping only being able to buy pork, like, look at the people that can only afford to get meat once a month, if that. Like, you can always, and I think that helps shift your brain into a different space when you start being aware and thankful for those everyday things that you live in, where people get used to their everyday life and then they're like, they just want better, and they start having contempt for life for not having what they think other people have. But if they actually had to know, it's like, you know, you want what I have, be willing to walk in my shoes. It's like, if you actually had to know behind the scenes what those people are going through, probably 95% of the time you'll be like, no, it's cool, I'll keep my life.
I think when we listen to this, we would think that, yes, it's maybe because you had very little or not much at all. But I think the best times, or where I feel the most joyous or are filled with the most gratitude, are those moments when I think about people having less than me, people not having a job. So I literally think it can happen at every single level of your life standard, your joy, your income bracket, your whatever it might be. There's an interesting narrative that I've followed during our conversations where, like you said now with the drugs conversation, where if somebody comes to your school and tell you not to do drugs, that might not be the best way to actually do it, which make all of us cringe in terms of like, no, but that should be the answer. Tell somebody not to do it. But to me, it's actually the moments where love was expressed to you that changed you the most.
Yeah,
it's the big guy hugging you. It's the guy picking you up down, alongside the street. It's what you've encountered in terms of community and friendships in your rehabilitation, and perhaps even now. And I think that's such a beautiful narrative, because, like, and the question that pops up in my mind is that if the guy that picked you up alongside the street came earlier when you were not done with drugs yet, would you have had the same recovery journey?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. So the sad thing is, if some people die there, and they're going to die there no matter what, until you've gotten to the end of yourself. It's because I know people now that I met on the street, that I left on the street, and they're still on the street. I probably know more people that have died than I have friends left living now. And it's just because that's some people's choice in life, as long as that's what they want from life. There's a guy on the streets here now. His dad's like a multimillionaire. His dad's told him, get off the streets. I'll pay for rehab, everything. If you just stay clean for 3 months, I'll put you in a flat. And instead of him grabbing at that offer, and that offer's been on the table for the last 6 years, instead of him just grabbing at that offer, he's got contempt for his father because he's like, my father's leaving me on the streets because if he actually just bought me the flat, I could be there and have somewhere to do drugs. And it's like, but your dad doesn't want to buy you a place to die. Like, your dad's just asking, like, just, you know. So I don't think that, yeah, it's I've never actually thought about it too in depth, but I think if he had met me, maybe if he'd met me in that previous 3 years, maybe, although I don't know how much of that suffering of those 3 years of being every day like, hey, God, I'm still being good. Like, you know, are you actually going to do something? I don't know how much of that suffering I needed to be in a place where I was done and done, you know, because even when I was in the restoration center after about 2 months, I had an offer for work. And when I was leaving, the guy that was running the center at the time, Stanley, he said to me, you know, I'm doing good. He's like, he's got, and I said to him, yeah, hopefully I stay clean this time. And I'll never forget, because he looked at me and it's such a simple thing. And he was like, no, bro, don't say that, because then you're going to use again. He says, like, hopefully means you haven't decided you're done. Be like, I'm done. I'm just like, using drugs isn't a choice for me anymore. I'm not hoping to stay clean. Like, I have to, like, it's not an option. And that flipped a very simple switch of like, yeah, it's not an option anymore. So now it wasn't coming back and being like, am I going to, am I not going to, am I going to make it today? It's like, yeah, I'm making it. I'm still making it. 10 years later, I'm still making it because it's an option that I took off the table. And I think a lot of life is like that. When you sort of decide what you're going to do, it makes knowing what not to do a lot easier. So I don't know if I'd met him earlier, if I would have been at the same place where I'd be like, yeah, no, I'm done. Or if I might have been like, ah, I only asked God for this a week ago and I got it, so I can actually use again and he'll send someone else. I honestly don't know.
Garo, thank you so much for sharing your story. I've been following you on social media for quite some time. And there's just a way that you've changed my perspective on viewing addiction, challenges, adversity. And to have become the man that you are today is truly an inspiration. I'm thankful for the person we know in common that picked you up next to the road. And I'm thankful for the person that you've become and that sits in front of me to tell these stories in the past and have healed, even though that's a continuous journey, but that have healed and have put in the hard work of spiritual formation to become who you are today. And it's really changed my thinking about and understanding about homelessness and hopelessness and hopefulness in terms of how you could go through those significant moments in your life and still come out on the other side being grateful and living a flourishing life. So from my side, I want to continue to encourage you to share your story. And I know we've had a discussion about the future of what you want to do. And I think once we get to that point, I would like to have a follow-up conversation where you can share more about that with the listeners, because I think that's an amazing journey. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We have a closing tradition on the podcast where we ask you a few quick fire questions where you just answer with the first thing that comes up in your mind.
Blue 17, the house.
Which book are you currently reading?
I don't have a book that I'm currently reading. I want to read. I'm just trying to get it. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Frank Turek.
Cool. Best piece of advice you've ever received?
Sure. Best piece of advice I've ever received was probably what I just said. Like, if you want to decide what you want, and it makes it easier knowing what you don't want, like with everything in life. Like, if you don't know what to do as a job, look at all the jobs you don't want to do, and it'll narrow down what you've got to do. You know, you don't want to drink in a drink anymore. Like, look at all the places where they drink and don't go there anymore. You don't want to be led into lust. Like, don't drive past teasers. Like, you know, it's just like, decide what you want. So decide where you want to be in 5 years, and then look at what you've got to put in place to get there.
Sure. Name one item on your bucket list.
It's going to sound very cringe, but anyway, handstand push-ups. Handstand push-ups.
Interesting. Your go-to activity when you want to relax or unwind?
Every day, 5:30, we in the ocean at Heart Bay. We do a 5:30 swim, and then we follow by an hour and a bit gym. That's sure. My unwind, and then obviously time with my family on weekends.
Mm. One tip to meet new people or make friends?
It's pretty much the same as like actual Facebook. Just go stand in a shopping center and start following someone around and just be like, hey, I like you. I think... That's a very weird thing, like, because you get people that are introverts that just don't, like, introverts are the strangest phenomenon to me. Like, one of my best friends at the moment is an introvert, but they want to have friends, but they don't want to go out. It's very weird. So I think depending on who you are, I mean, obviously you've got to put yourself out there, but try and do it in places or arenas that you're comfortable in. And you'll naturally meet people, and then just like be real. Like, even if you don't like your own personality, still just be real with who that is, because then you can actually build friendships and relationships that can last. Where if you're going somewhere and trying to pretend to be something or someone just to fit in, you're not actually building anything grounded in truth or honesty, and it's not relationships that are going to fulfill you in any case, because it's going to be more taxing coming back from that, being like, oh, I had to pretend to be nice the whole time. Oh, I had to pretend to like his wife. Like, oh, what a, you know, just like go out and be real. And like, you know, you'll meet people, do group activities.
Favorite sport to watch or play yourself?
So I don't watch sport at all.
Is there a reason for that?
Better things to do with my time.
Sure.
Like, I've got 3 small kids. I've got a wife. Life is so busy, and I feel like we spend so much of it on useless things. So what I'm trying to do at the moment is, I've sort of, a few months ago, about a year ago, I made a list of my, you know, even clever people will tell you to do this. I made a list of what my time gets spent on in a day. And then I took everything off the list that doesn't enrich my life. So I'm trying to only do things that add value to me or to the people around me. Otherwise, and the only exception to that is at night before I go to bed, I get half an hour of Netflix or an hour of Netflix. Well, or till I fall asleep. but like, I'll sit because it helps have my brain switch off, because it runs a lot. But other than that, whoever wins the Formula One, going to make absolutely no difference to my life. Mm-hmm. Whoever wins the rugby, no difference to my life. So, and then sport, I'm up for anything. I do the OCR thing, the obstacle course racing and stuff we do for fun. But I'm a people's person, so I like doing things that's group activities, whether that's, you know, going kayaking as a group or just anything outdoors and physical and not on a screen is great to me.
Sure. Last question. What is your favorite outdoor activity?
Ocean swims. Yeah, they're not very nice, but they're so good for you.
Yeah, I was trying to get on board with that thought and encourage it. But
like, yeah, so at the moment, like, we're very lucky. So there's something, so the cold water, you get used to it after about 2 minutes because you don't feel the numbness anymore, and then you can just sort of float through for the rest of the time. But it's like we swim in Heart Bay Beach, which is surrounded by mountains. So now with our beautiful country and load shedding, it's like, how many people can be in an ocean surrounded by mountains under a blanket of stars, like, 7 days a week? It's just, it's something special there. And even that, like, I'm very, when I drive and stuff, I'm very, if I can just quickly add this for 2 minutes, there's this book this guy wrote, Viktor Frankl. He was in the concentration camps. And he did a study of who's dying and who's not dying, and he wanted to see why, even though all their conditions are the same, are some people dying and some people are living. And what he found was the people that were actually carrying on living despite their circumstances were the people that, even though they're half-dressed in the snow, busy shoveling, they'd hear a bird singing and they'd stop and listen to the bird, or they'd see a sunset and stop and take it. So I think if we focused on the beautiful things in life that God's naturally put here for us, it sort of just enriches your soul and brings you a bit of joy as well. But it's very good for the immune system as well.
Sure. On that powerful note, thank you so much, Gary. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Framework to Flourish podcast, hosted by Marco Haasbroek and produced in collaboration with Imagine This. For today's episode, Stefanie de Tooy was our coordinator, John Rehoog our technical producer, and Karina Kloppers our content producer. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn at Flourish Workshops to stay up to date with our latest episodes, workshops, and retreats. Until next time, keep going and growing.